Welcome to the Authentically American Podcast, featuring inspiring stories from great Americans who are making a difference. Your host is West Point grad, former Army Ranger, and founder of Authentically American, Dean Wegner.
Welcome to the Authentically American Podcast, featuring the inspiring stories of great Americans who are making a difference. I'm your host, Dean Wegner. It is my tremendous privilege to be joined by my friend and special guest, U.S. Congressman Dr. Mark Green. Dr. Green has lived an extraordinary life, having graduated from West Point, becoming an Army Ranger, a decorated combat veteran, as well as an ER doctor and successful business leader, all before his recent career as a public servant. We could talk to Congressman Green about his experiences for hours without getting to all of them. You'll find out very quickly how compelling his story of service to country and community is, and no part is more compelling than his role in helping capture Saddam Hussein. You're not going to want to miss today's episode with Congressman Mark Green. Mark, thank you so much for joining us here, and as I think about you and your career and where all you've been, it's hard to even think where to begin with you being a congressman, business leader, decorated combat veteran, ER physician. Yeah. Why don't we go all the way back to the beginning where you talked about growing up on a dirt road in Mississippi? So where did it all start here with you?
Yeah, well, I actually was born in Jacksonville, Florida, and my dad, about age two or three, got a job in Mississippi, so we moved to Mississippi, and it was a dirt road for probably until I was about 12 or 13. You know, my grandparents didn't have indoor plumbing.
Oh, wow.
You know, so we grew up pretty poor. I learned those small town values of hard work and honesty. When you grow up in a small town and everybody knows you, it's not like you can, you know, deceive anybody. Everybody sees it. So, you know, honesty, hard work, those are just some of the base values.
So those are some of the foundation for where your career went?
Yeah, I think so. I think if my dad taught me anything, of course, my parents taught me about faith in God and all that stuff, but my dad really modeled hard work. My dad lost his arm when I was in first grade, and the company that he worked for, this was before Americans with Disabilities Act, so there was no laws on how to treat people who are handicapped or anything like that, disabled. So when he lost his arm, they told him, "You're half of a man, so we're going to pay you half a salary."
Wow.
So my dad was a foreman on a paper machine, so he was making really good money, and he got cut in half, and my dad was pretty proud. He wasn't going to go ask anybody for any help. So this guy with one arm starts roofing houses and painting houses and doing all this extra work to make ends meet. So I have the image of my dad bundling, balancing shingles on the stump of his arm, going up a ladder, and then when he would start the nails. It was all pre-nail gun, so he'd take the nail, every nail, and start it in the palm of his hand, thunk, and then take out the hammer and drive it in.
Wow.
And so that's, when people look at my life and go, "Oh, that guy's, he's driven and all that," and it's because that's what I grew up watching, a guy who was not going to be stopped. And, and then there was, West Point and Army and all that after that, but... Yeah, so that was where I grew up.
Your dad's like the backbone of America. When you think of that rock-solid American that's there to do a great day's work for an honest day's pay.
Yeah, that's my dad.
Yeah.
He would later go on to become a pastor, as I was in high school and leaving. But, it was just work. I learned to work. Learned to work hard.
I know much of your life, you've mentioned West Point, military, and being a physician, so... Was that a vision from an early age, or where did that come about?
The whole West Point thing was more, it was accidental. I think I knew I wanted to serve, but I was in my guidance counselor's office, and I looked down and I see the West Point catalog sitting on the floor, and I picked it up, and I'm like, "What about this place?" And she goes, "Hey, you'll never get in there." And then I went home to my mom and dad, and I'm like, "What about this?" And dad's like, you're not going to get accepted, son. Don't. And later now he's told me he was just saying that to get me to, fired up and to go prove myself. But when I heard that, I'm like, okay, that's where I'm going.
You knew the button to push. It's the challenge.
Oh, yeah,
I'll show you, Dad.
Yeah, I'll show you. And so, there was always a patriotic bent to our family. My dad served. His brothers all served. His brother went to Vietnam. My dad was a little older and served during more like the Korean era. But service was important. Getting a great education was important, and being able to, you know, have the military pay for it was essential. So,
your dad was working hard, but it doesn't provide for an expensive education.
No. That when I left home, with a few pennies in my pocket, kind of deal. Mm-hmm. They eventually would pay some. My dad could fly me home, you know, as a cadet, but that was about it.
So, how about the military plus being a physician?
Yeah.
Is that something you envisioned?
Not medicine, no. When I left West Point, and we branch into one of the branches in the Army, I thought, if you can't be in the Air Force, if you can't fly fighter jets, why be in the Air Force? If you can't be an Army Ranger, why be in the Army? That was my thought. So I'm like, I'm going to go be an infantry officer and go to Ranger School, and I did. And, that was an amazing experience. I think I learned more about leading in Ranger School than I did at West Point.
Oh, yeah.
4 years at West Point taught me, how to present myself well and how to, take boards, right? Mm-hmm. And getting up in West Point even uses its math classes to teach us how to present ourselves. But what I really learned at Ranger School was how to move people in a crisis moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very, very important and paid dividends when I became an ER physician. But the medicine was sort of another one of those, inflection moments that God kind of puts in our lives and in our steps. And so I'm in command in the 82nd Airborne Division, thinking that I'm going to, this is my chosen career. I'm going to be an infantry officer and hopefully succeed at the highest levels of the Army and lead at those levels. And my dad almost dies. And again, this connection to my father, but dad's esophagus ruptured. He got a chest infection all through his chest, technically termed a mediastinitis. And he was supposed to die on the ventilator for like 40 something days. Every day the doctor came and said, well, we're doing this and we're doing that, and we just don't know. And the guy who was that doctor, that ICU doctor, was an ex-military guy whom the Army had sent mid-career to medical school. I'm like, man, you think maybe I could do that? And so I talked to the Army after that. The guy basically saved my dad's life and said, hey, I want to do what that guy does. And they said, well, if you get accepted to medical school, we'll take you. My undergrad degree's in economics,
Right.
So I'm like, okay, well, I'll volunteer for recruiting command because you don't get deployed.
Yeah.
And I can get a consistent night schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took night classes and commanded a recruiting company. And I chose a recruiting company that was in Ohio because Ohio had the best applicant-to-entrant ratio and for med schools, being strategic like I am. And so I commanded a recruiting company in that town and then got accepted to their medical school. And,
fantastic.
Yeah.
Dad may have done another one where you'll never get accepted. And
yeah, well. And my mom, I do remember her saying, I just don't know if this makes sense,
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, I think this is what I'm supposed to do.
Right.
And we did it. And then, residency and then back in the Army. So.
Yeah. So now you served as a night stalker.
Yeah.
Yeah. Combating the war on terror. And there was one of those missions that you've even wrote a book about. So tell us a little bit about that whole experience.
Sure.
Yeah.
I was in my third year. Last year of my ER residency, in keeping with my personality, I like going 1,000 miles an hour with my hair on fire, so I'm going to be an ER doc, right?
Uh-huh.
And we were literally weeks before we were determining where we would serve as ER physicians. I'm senior class, I'm about to graduate, and 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically changed everything.
Oh, yeah.
Right? We knew we were going to war. And within a few days of that, I got a call from a guy by the name of Rocky Farr, who was the U.S. Army Special Operations Command command sergeant. And he said, are you that ex-Army Ranger who's now an ER doc? Yeah, that's me. He's like, okay, there's a plane ticket in your mailbox. You're coming to the dark side of the force. And so I flew up to Fort Campbell, interviewed with the 160th, the Night Stalkers, Interestingly enough, the movie Black Hawk Down came out right about that time, which is the story of them in Somalia. Really, when they became, you know, they were very deep black up until that movie, and then it, or that show, everybody knew who the Night Stalkers were after that. Yeah, I interviewed with them and got the job, and of course deployed, and then Saddam was pretty much the intensity of the beginning, or the beginning of the war was finding Saddam, finding WMD. So I'm doing all these hits all over the country, and some even before, you know, the country had fallen. So we were forward of the you know, behind enemy lines, you might say. And those missions were pretty intense, pretty emotional. Had some friends get hit, and so that anyway, we eventually get Saddam, and I'm unbelievably in the room with him, you know.
Walk me through that mission, because I want to go back maybe the day of where you realize that, you know what, that's been our mission all along, but it's going to be here. So walk me through.
Well, it was really about 3 weeks. You know, you've been in the military. The thing you battle is complacency, right, as you do mission after mission after mission, and you don't get your bad guy, right? So but our organization is very good about that, you know, making sure that no one gets complacent and we keep doing these hits. Well, about 3 weeks before we got to that, we actually got him, the tempo started picking up.
Okay.
And we started getting what we thought were closer and closer. We got his Saddam's girlfriend, and then about a week or so after that, we got his secretary, which I don't know what that means, but you know, he called himself Saddam's secretary. Then we captured Saddam's physician. Okay. His personal doctor, and that we knew we were getting close then. All these enablers are beginning to fall, and it's like, okay, and then, you know, I'm sitting in my cot, and they say, hey, we're going now. Let's go. We kit up, load the aircraft, and launch. Very little planning time.
Happens that quickly. You get intel, and then...
Yeah, you launch. And we had done, you know, those guys are so good. I mean, they're the best of the best. They're the Jedi Knights of the military. the tier one asset that actually got him off the target. We flew the mission. I was actually in a 53 Air Force Special Operation helicopter, an MH-53, and that was our CASEVAC aircraft. So we go, there were no casualties on the target. They pulled Saddam off and he was fine. Excuse me. So I never got to the target. I'm in sort of this waiting area in the sky and on the ground waiting. We fly back after they capture him. And what's interesting, just it's kind of cool, you know, being in the back of that helicopter and you hear over the radio the various code words of which buildings have been cleared and all this stuff. And then it sounds like they're saying them again, as if they're checking the target a second time.
Oh, wow.
And then we hear this operator very excitedly come on the net and say, we've got big jackpot, or we've got jackpot is what he said. And Admiral McCraven then came on and said, do you have big jackpot or little jackpot? So apparently there was a cook, which I kind of think was probably more like a cupbearer to the king, you know, the guy who tested the food before Saddam ate it. But so the operator goes, we've got big jackpot. We've got big jackpot. Well, I'm in the back of a helicopter, all kitted up, body armor, you know, weapon, and we're high-fiving. And
you hear this, like, it's for real.
We got him, you know. I mean, you think about it in history. We never caught Pol Pot. We never caught Hitler. I mean, you think of all these totalitarian dictators who murdered hundreds of thousands of people, and Saddam is one of those.
Oh, yeah.
And a million people lost their lives in the Iran-Iraq War. And I'm there, a part of capturing him. So we get back, and I'm like, well, I got to go see this guy, you know. Yeah. So I go over, and I'm sitting outside the detention facility room, and again, Admiral McCraven comes out and says, hey, Mark, I want a doctor to stay with him, you know, and will you spend this night with him? And I'm like, you want me to spend the first night in captivity of Saddam Hussein? Yeah.
I think I'll do that.
I'm in, sir. So I go in, and I'm there with him, spend that night with him.
So what was that like?
It was surreal.
Even imagine.
Sort of almost like a out of body experience. You know, I'm sitting there thinking, feeling like I'm watching it from outside as it goes down.
You got this whole historical perspective that you talked about, and then for weeks, if not months on end, you've been searching, and it's real, and there you are.
Yeah, I tell people it's a lot like winning a Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's at least that. But a Super Bowl is every year. Okay. I mean, somebody is a Super Bowl champion every year. This was one time in history where we hunted and captured a totalitarian dictator. You could argue Manuel Noriega, but he was a thug. You know, some executed people, thousands of people, you know. And so I got to be on that team and then interview him. Being in the room was wild. And I thought it was just going to be watching him sleep. And he sits up about midway through, motions me over to take his blood pressure. You know, when you're taking somebody's blood pressure, you're in their face. And he's in your face, and I'm taking it and listening and looking at him. And he goes to me, you know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a doctor. But politics had too great a hold on my heart. Mm. And so the butcher, the image of the butcher of Baghdad taking the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm, you know, started the conversation that lasted about 6 hours. And he didn't sleep, and he didn't seem like he wanted to sleep, so I just sat there and asked him questions.
One question that sticks out from that hours and hours on end that you say?
I think probably, yeah. I mean, there's one that was clearly an answer to history because it was in no other history books, and it's probably part of the reason why I wrote my story. Yeah. Is because he just told me some things that were never, ever recorded anywhere else. Mm-hmm. One was, why did you start the Iran-Iraq war? You know, why did you invade Iran? And he shared the story that when Khomeini was in in Iran, you know, and the Shah was still in power, Khomeini fled Iran and went to Karbala, Iraq. I think it was Karbala. It's in my book, but it's been so long now. But he went to a city in Iraq, and he is a Shia cleric in a mostly Shia country being led by a Sunni Saddam Hussein. So the threat of having, you know, Khomeini there potentially upsetting and leading to overthrow and instability compelled Saddam to go talk to him. So he goes down there, meets with him, says, hey, look, okay, fine, you can stay here. But when you come to power in Iran, I want you to cede some coastline to me, because if you understand how the Persian Gulf is, you know, Iraq has very little
sliver.
It's tiny. And so, of course, Saddam wanted some coastline so that he could export more oil and all that. Well, Khomeini made the promise. And then Khomeini eventually goes to France before the fall of the Shah. And eventually the Shah falls. Saddam gets ignored by Khomeini. And so basically Saddam said, I went to take by force what was promised to me in a deal.
Wow.
And that was in no other history books. So I said, okay, that's straight from Saddam. It's in my book. But I mean, and there were other questions like that. It was a fascinating night, you know, talking to this guy. And his answers were all very cogent. I mean, it wasn't like they didn't make sense on some level.
Mm-hmm. We could spend hours.
Yeah.
But let's transition to the next chapter, because you're one of our American heroes. You've got a decorated military career and then business.
Yeah. I just felt like there was a better way to do emergency medicine. Mm-hmm. You know, run ERs. Much of healthcare in its evolution in America, particularly as it relates to hospitals, were set up to be, you know, the physician brought the patient to the hospital. So people went to their doctor, and then their doctor brought them to the hospital. And that's how it was for the longest period of time. I mean, as late as the 70s, we didn't have emergency rooms. And we were just beginning. It was a place where you went to the back and you knocked on the door, and some sleepy person who'd been, you know, comes and opens, what do you want, you know? That used to be the emergency department. But that whole genre of medicine began to develop early to late 70s, and now people go to the ER. Mm-hmm. And that's how, you know what I mean? It becomes the front door of the hospital. So the hospital is designed back then to recruit physicians to bring their patients to the hospital. It's a very provider-centric model.
Right.
Well, as the ER became such a front door to the hospital, the hospitals, it took them too long to catch on. Mm-hmm. And so we came in and we created our company, and it was about patients from the time they hit the door to the time we either discharged them out of the emergency department or we brought them upstairs to admit them to the hospital. So it became very patient-centric. And that company now, you know, we started it in, I think 2009 is when we changed the name. I started the business, I think, in 08, but in 09 we changed it to AlignMD. That's when I mm-hmm. took that name, and then you know, sold it in, I think 15, sold a big chunk of it in 15, and then left the company in 17. So when I left, we were at about 52 emergency departments in 11 wow. states, a little over $200 million in revenue. Now, you know, in talking with the guys, because they're obviously my friends, and, you know, sure. yeah, they've done some amazing things. The company is now well over 100 emergency departments. Its valuation is over $1 billion. So I can say, wait a minute, I started something that became a $1 billion company.
You saw a need.
Yeah.
And from a blank sheet of paper.
Yeah. Yeah, we created it from nothing. My first year revenue was about, I had one contract and one employee, me. And we had $180,000 in revenue that year, and then the year I walked completely away, it was a little over $200 million.
Yeah. So, probably another area where Ranger School came into handy, because I joke that Ranger School is a great training for a startup.
It is great training for a startup, absolutely. You know, I think what really, where I got, what helped me most in the company was from Special Operations. Mm-hmm. Because Special Operations, we had the motto, we before me. And it was all about, in the unit that I was in at least, and it was all about the team and not the individual. And the individual was a piece of the team, but the team, it was the team that mattered, right? And so we took that philosophy to my company, and the people that I hired, I wanted to make sure they had that heart for culture, and we made culture a target on the wall. And we wanted people to really feel like they were a part of something special. And we did, I think. We created a great culture. We haven't lost a contract. That company still hasn't lost a New York contract.
Quite a success
story. That's amazing.
From a blank sheet of paper to where it's at right now.
Yeah.
So I know you've always been a big believer in giving back. And tell me about the clinics that you founded.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about this. We mm-hmm. started a clinic at Manna Cafe in Clarksville, Tennessee. And then started one in True Vines Baptist Church in Memphis. Now, the one in Memphis right now is closed down. They're rebuilding the whole thing. They basically took an old school, and they're making this massive clinic. And I can't wait till they, you know, open the doors on that clinic. But they were very quickly overrun. And it's in a rough part of town, you know, a very disadvantaged part of Memphis. And so there's a lot of need.
Oh, yeah.
And they became overwhelmed, so they decided, well, we just got to make it bigger. But yeah, it's pretty exciting, and this will kind of tell you a little bit about politics. I was running for this most recent race, and the Tennessean calls, you know, they want to know that they can't find anything on my clinics, and they think that I'm just, you know, making all this up, right? So
smoking man.
Yeah, we're going to get to the bottom of this. Green's being deceptive. He really doesn't have these clinics. And so they call around to the people up in Manna Cafe. And, of course, you know, they talk to Dr. Stanley, who took the clinic over after I started running. And, you know, they find out that we're giving about $100,000 worth of free care away, you know, from this clinic. And it's not a huge amount, but it's helping a lot of people. Yeah. And they decide, we're not going to do the article anymore.
They were fishing. And
they were all ready to do the article when they thought it wasn't true. And then they found out, wait, Green really does have these free clinics. Ah, we don't need to do the article now.
Got buried.
Yeah. Well, it didn't get printed. Yeah. It just wasn't a story.
Well, speaking of that, because you've always had a servant spirit. You've want to serve and give back.
Yeah,
and one way you did that was serving our country in the military. But then what was it that said, you know what, as an elected official?
Yeah.
Most people would say, you're crazy. What are you thinking, Mark?
There are still days when I think I'm crazy. You know, when I see somebody call me something that I know I'm not, you know, that really bothers me. But it is what it is. It's where we are in American politics. But I was thinking that the clinics would be my life's work. Mm-hmm. That would be my sort of give back. And but I made the mistake of going to my 25th reunion at West Point. And prior to that, Ron Ramsey, then the lieutenant governor of Tennessee and a great Tennessee politician, came to me and said, hey, I want you to run for the state senate. And I'm like, okay, I don't think I want to do that. But I go back for the reunion. And the reunions at West Point, they start off with a little, your class gathering, and there's a presentation on how the academy's changed. You've probably been to some.
Oh, yeah. Just had mine last year.
Did you?
Yeah,
all right. What year was that? 25th. Okay. Yeah. You're getting old.
Relating
too,
very well. Don't tell anybody.
Okay. All right. We'll keep that. You're there, and they present how the academy's changed, and then he puts the slide up that says this hasn't changed. Yeah. The purpose of West Point, the mission of West Point hasn't changed. It's still to train a leader for a lifetime of service to the country. And I thought, oh my gosh, I took taxpayer dollars. Mm-hmm. To go to a school, I took a slot from somebody else, to go to a school whose purpose was to train a leader who would serve the nation for his lifetime or her lifetime. And I thought, oh my gosh. So it was like an arrow through me, right? I go from there to the plane. So we walk out of the briefing at Eisenhower Hall up onto the plane at West Point. And for those of us who, that's like holy ground to us.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, MacArthur is there, Patton, the nation's history. Benedict Arnold and George Washington fighting the British. And the first statue I encounter, of course, is MacArthur's. I bypassed Thayer's somehow and got to MacArthur. And I'm looking at the quote engraved on the statue. You know the one I'm talking about. Duty, honor, country, those three hallowed words reverently dictate what you can be, what you ought to be, what you will be. Mm-hmm. And the word duty would not get out of my head. Yeah. And so I'm sitting there thinking, duty, the mission of West Point, and holy cow, I got to go do this. So I called up Ron Ramsey and said, all right, I'll do it. I'll run for office. And I ran, and I found out that I really liked it. Oh. I mean, my first parade was my first political experience, and it was Houston County, the Aaron Irish Day Parade.
Right.
And it's like this town of 1,500 people swells to 25,000. If you've never done the Irish parade in Houston County, you've got to go. It's big. So I buy 500 Irish flags that I'm going to hand out to the little kids on Irish Day, right? So I get there, and we're driving, and I'm walking the parade, shaking hands, handing these flags out. Mm-hmm. And it was just thrilling to me. Yeah. I had a blast. And seeing the look in those kids' eyes, and then you go do other political things, and then you get in office and you actually get an opportunity to make a difference. So I, my first bill when I was a state senator was to allow veterans to turn in their military driver's license and get issued a commercial driver's license from Tennessee. I thought, if you can drive an 18-wheeler in Baghdad, you're probably okay in the streets of Memphis, So those kinds of things, making a difference, became very rewarding. One of my first bills that first year was in rape kits. I as an ER physician, I had done so many rape kits, and it's the most horrible thing for a woman to ever go through. And just being in that moment with them and, having to do that with them and be there with them really motivated me to try to do something about this. So I passed a bill that the DNA sample could be charged as a John Doe if we didn't know the person, stopping the statute of limitations, so that 30 years from now, if they get a match, that guy goes to jail. And other things like that. I passed a bill that nurses, 50% of workplace violence occurs against female nurses in hospitals.
Wow.
And yeah, it's shocking, isn't it? Other professions add up, they equal nurses in hospitals. And so I passed a bill making it the same as assaulting a police officer to assault a nurse in a hospital. And that's just laws that I could pass and make a difference,
Yeah. So speaking of making a difference, Mark, I just think of the unique perspective you have, having gone to West Point, served our country, been a physician, been an entrepreneur, been a business owner, been a state senator, and now you're 3 months into being our U.S. Congressman for our district here. So, I mean, it's tough to think from a macro level making a difference, but with that unique perspective you have, where would you say your priorities? What are you planning to do to make a difference while you're there?
For me, it all comes back to the one word I would use to describe our country, and that word is freedom. When America was founded, almost all of the governments of the world were monarchies, where the desires of the king were never denied. Our founders amazingly came up with this idea of spreading power out, distributing it amongst branches of government, and then distributing it amongst levels of government. So federal, state, local. And the federal government wasn't supposed to do what the local and the state guys do. And you know, and the branches weren't, you know, the judiciary would do the, they would stay in the judiciary lane. They wouldn't try to legislate from the bench. That was, you know, that was the intent of this thing. And I think the federal government has gotten too big, and it is encroaching on the freedoms of Americans. And so one of my big important missions is to try my best to decrease the size and scope of the federal government and return power to the states where it belonged in the first place on many, many things. And that's sort of at the 100,000 foot level. Yeah. You know, at the tactical level, though, there's many little things too. I'll give you an example. My first bill that I filed was Gold Star wives. Gold Star spouses, wives and husbands who lost a wife or husband in combat. That makes them a Gold Star family. They get benefits, you know. And when our government shuts down, meaning when Congress can't do its job and they can't pass a budget that the, you know, two sides agree on, the government shuts down. And when the government shuts down, the Gold Star families weren't getting their benefits. And I thought that was
wrong.
That is just as wrong as anything. Right. You know,
should be at the top of the list.
That's right. That's as wrong as a football bat. I mean, it's just wrong, right? Yeah. So what do we do? Mm-hmm. We pass a bill, we write this bill, and it basically makes their benefits just like Social Security. So they cannot be stopped even in a government shutdown.
What's the status now? Is that
bill's moving through committee, and we're working on it. I've got about four other bills. One naming certain cartels, drug cartels, as terrorist organizations, which allows more resources of the federal government to pounce on them. We can seize their financial assets. Three of the cartels are really functioning like terrorist organizations. Wow. They're cutting people's heads off, intimidation. So myself and Chip Roy from Texas put that bill forward. I've got a constitutional amendment to keep the Supreme Court at 9 justices. We don't need to stack the court with a bunch of, you know, folks who believe that the Constitution is a living document and can be interpreted how they think it ought to be interpreted.
Still amazes me the vision of our founding fathers and what they put together.
It really is amazing.
I'll tell you, Marcus, I just look at the time. I could spend all day.
I know.
Sharing stories.
I will say this, though. Uh-huh. You know, our founders created an amazing system for freedom, but they didn't finish the job. You know, it took Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King and many, many other Americans to come along and advance freedom a step at a time. But our democracy, we began democratic government across the nation, or across the globe. I mean, we really are that. We are that special. We have fought for freedom all over the globe, Europe, the Pacific. And we never ask for anything more than a place to bury our dead. And there is no nation like that in history. And there is no nation that's ever done a Marshall Plan. You know, we beat our enemy, and then we rebuilt their country. Nobody does that in history. We are special. And people need to know this is a special place. No matter how many hiccups and mistakes and failings, it is still a very special country in the history of man, and I think it can be great. It continue to be great. So,
well, Mark, we do live in a special country, and you're a special person, and I am proud to call you a friend.
Thank you.
And thank you for having served and continuing to serve our country. And you're familiar with Authentically American.
Oh, I am indeed.
Gift for you that every member of Congress should
absolutely
have.
Absolutely.
Proud American Patriot socks. I know
that
everyone can't
awesome
see them, but one is the red and white stripes, and the other one is the blue and white stars. So hope you wear those proudly on the floor.
Absolutely.
And share with some of your friends, because every member of Congress should have them. And then,
we can probably make that happen.
Given now that we beat Navy, how many years in a row?
Three in a row.
We
need a four-peat.
So we have some West Point socks, but this was our
awesome
commemorative one for this past year. Beat Navy.
Yeah. I love it.
Three-peat there. So
there you go.
Now that one's a little more casual. Oftentimes you got to get dressed up, so this will be fun for you to dress down. And
that's awesome. There's plenty of opportunity for you. D.C. is concentration of academy folks. You know, my classmates, Mike Pompeo, and so, you know, we see this will be great. Thank you.
Well, wear these proud.
I will indeed.
Well, Mark, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Authentically American Podcast. You can follow Authentically American on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and find all our episodes at authenticallyamerican.us/podcast. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Thank you for listening.